David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 440. I'm your host, Steve Raker, toiling away in the comic book bunker with my beehive helmet-wearing AIM henchmen, WWX Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit. How's that unstable research going, guys?
This helmet is too stuffy.
Yours doesn't have the vent in the back?
I feel protected.
I have the old model.
Marvel Noise is the now 17-year-old semi-monthly Marvel-centric podcast that's proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find episodes past and present over on MarvelNoise.com and find other fine pop culture podcasts on the Deliberate Noise Network run by devilish Derek Coward, one of them being Indie Comic Book Noise, where Kevin, Andrew, Phil, and sometimes I talk up the indie comic books we're digging. And look for a Halloween episode around this time. It's that time of year, right?
Indeed.
It was our anniversary. We started with indie, so got to keep those traditions up.
Oh, that's right. The first indie podcast that we did was a Halloween episode.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, this on here on Marvel Noise is our seasonal Halloween episode. So we've got some Halloweeny selections from the House of Ideas vast library, starting with material over 70 years old. We're going way back to the 1950s, to the Atlas era of comics that followed the company's time as Timely and prior to the rebranding as Marvel Comics.
Yeah, and they have this in one of those nice, swanky Marvel Masterworks as well.
Yep, and it is on the Marvel Unlimited Digital Service, too. At the end of 1952, Atlas writer, editor-in-chief Stan Lee served up his version of an EC book. I mean, you know, Atlas had anthologies like Strange Tales and such, but EC editor Al Feldstein had a formula of drawing from a really small pool of artists and just having them churn out stories over and over, keeping the production really tight with as few hands as possible, all overseen by editor-in-chief Bill Gaines. And what resulted was Menace, an 11-issue series that ran from December of 1952 to January of 1954, with Stan Lee editing and writing all of the stories for the first 7 monthly issues. After issue 8, the title went on a 3-month hiatus and then returned for 3 more, this time bi-monthly issues, before the series ended with issue 11.
He's a menace.
And these were pre-code horror comics, despite the conforms to the comic code stamps that they would have on the front, because that was the Association of Comics Magazine Publishers code, which was basically the unenforced precursor to the comics code.
Yeah, and that they also have this 8-page introduction by Dr. Michael J. Sallow, who I think, if I'm not mistaken, Andrew brought up either here on Indie for another historical comic booky thing.
He's a good comics historian for sure.
I have a slight confession to make, guys. I, as is my wont, I only read one of the 2-page text stories in these things.
Oh, I don't read
the text. I just start to read them and, yeah, they just kind of lose interest at some point.
I wasn't even going to mention them. But as for the cabal of artists, he trying to recreate that EC formula by having a small group that he kept drawing from, Stan's leadoff hitter was Bill Everett, the creator of The Submariner, doing covers and one story in each of the first 6 issues, plus drawing a story for issue number 9 and the cover to number 10. So he's all over this series. And I am an unabashed, wear it on my shirt sleeve, huge fan of Bill Everett's art. His heroes, his goons, his babes, his backgrounds, the fashions, his methods of depicting action, the textures and stuff. I mean, he was a true master who only got better and better as time went on. It's not like some of the other guys where, well, maybe it's because he died young, but not that young, all things considered. But, you know, there wasn't a period where it's like, oh, man, his stuff really started to fall off. It just got better and better and better until his untimely death in the early 70s.
Yeah, it's also fun for me. I think I was more familiar with that stuff. As you guys know, I don't read a ton of Golden Age, so it's kind of fun to look at his Golden Age stuff that's less familiar to me than like that Silver Age.
And there's some really good stuff in here. That there's some fun bunch of artists that are certainly going to be familiar names as we pick through, especially the first bunch of issues here. The opening story in Menace number 1 was drawn by Everett, and it is One Head Too Many, where a guy investigates a UFO in Central Park and gets abducted by Martians, and he's sent back to Earth with a message to stave off a Martian invasion, but when he returns, he sabotages the whole peace message because he's a moon man intending on his own invasion after Earth and Mars duke it out.
Yeah, I was kind of like, how is this going to work out? I'm like, oh, I see.
I loved Everett's almost swamp creature-y looking two-headed Martians. Really,
the textures overall are great. When he does the Earth, like the land masses are all kind of fuzzy and everything to match the aliens. And the inside of their spaceship is more organic looking in some ways.
I thought of the He-Man. What's that guy with the two heads?
Modulok? Is that the one? I'm not sure. <guy. laughs>
I just know there's the different guys. And then when this guy like rips off his like skin mask, and I'm like, oh, that's a little creepy.
After a text piece is The Man Who Couldn't Move with art by George Tuska, where a dude gets seduced by a woman married to a paralyzed guy who also might be in a coma. And she wants him to be her chauffeur and to kill her husband while out driving him, which he does. But he gets his coat sleeve caught in the car door and gets carried off a cliff, survives, but awakens paralyzed himself, overhearing the same woman hiring a new chauffeur to off him.
Oh, I hate when that happens.
I love how Stan gets his name signed on almost all of these. Yeah. Some artists like Russ Heath is smart about that, but
yeah,
old Stan doesn't miss a beat with it.
He knows how it is. I'm like, those other guys should have been right there. Yeah, I'm signing my name too.
And Tuska was a company man, right? He was the blue collar banging out stuff. I love how he used Little Orphan Annie style pupil-less eyeballs to on like the coma dude when they paralyzed. That was a creepy, but it also made him look really like vacant and not there. Poor Mr. Watkins has art by Werner Roth, where this blowhard guy tortures a meek librarian and even pranks him at his home. But unfortunately for him, the librarian's a werewolf. He never should have followed him home.
But what are wrong? I really think if you're like thinking of those old X-Men, you might want to look at this one.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have put that the same guy doing those as doing this story.
But yeah. Like I never knew of Werner Roth of anywhere else but some of those early X-Men issues. So it's kind of cool to see that. All right, here he was a decade earlier banging out anthology stories. Then the issue ends with They Wait in Their Dungeon with art by Russ Heath, where this horribly evil warden pushes the inmates too far and they have a mutiny, and he's on the run and reaches a fortified door, only it's the gas chamber with fumes still lingering from a execution that just happened a little earlier. So it ends with a dilemma where he either has to let the mob tear him to pieces or open the door and die a horrible death inside.
You know he's evil, Steve, because he's a fat guy.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those would you rathers. family fun game.
Yeah, these. I mean, they're not like so over the top and violent, but yeah, there's some interesting dilemmas for sure.
I feel like it started stronger from a story. Like, the art's fantastic throughout, but the stories kind of fade in my record. I mean, there aren't a few good ones towards the end, but I was also smart and read these in like 2 to 3 issue chunks.
Yes.
For me, yeah. Like, I can't read.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to sit down and read all 11 of these. It would just kind of wash into the. Because sometimes you get the feeling old Stan was just doing what he could to get by.
The second issue has a great cover by Everett. With that
that's classic.
Creepy-looking vampire creature. And all the covers featured a kind of a big panel and then 3 smaller panels suggesting what the other stories in the book are, which is kind of a fun format for the book to have. The second issue starts with The Man in Black with art by George Tuska, where we see the rise of this, like through the communist army ranks of this soldier who becomes a spy. And I mean, he's given everything to the USSR, right? Like, he even kills his father on the spot when he's told to. But he accidentally mistakes his contact for the man he's supposed to kill. And then all of a sudden he's on the, you know, the other side of an oppressive government and becomes the victim of his own regime.
He was expecting some aliens.
A gripping, realistic portrayal of communist Russia. Not over the top in the least, you know. Very grounded.
Burton's Blood with art by Bill Everett has a vampire engorging himself on blood during the atomic war of 1998. So many victims. So much so that he's going to like sleep like Rumpelstiltskin, and sleep he does for many, many years, awakens in a futuristic world. But when he tries, he can't feed on the jolly fat guy. He tries and he tries, but there are no humans left. Only robots. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh.
You know, if I can be a robot, I'm not going to be a fat guy.
I know, but how good is Bill Everett to, like, think of, you know what, I'm going to make it be a fat guy who would, like, look like the perfect plump dish for the vampire to lure him in, right? I mean, one of Everett's charms, even when he was drawing, and we've talked about this before, like his henchmen all looked different, right? There was the tall, skinny guy, the short, fat guy, the medium-sized Italian guy. He was great at drawing different plastic faces and different caricatures.
Yeah, and I like how this one's a jolly fat guy.
He really is.
It's like one of those surrogates, one of those things. Like, you want to get all these different types of skins going on.
The fourth story, Rocket to the Moon, is drawn by Joe Sinnott with this awful scientist bossing around and, I mean, really mentally torturing his assistant. And then when the assistant builds a rocket to the moon, the evil scientist boss dude clubs him over the head and wants to get the credit for himself and takes his place, not knowing that it was a one-way trip.
Wah-wah.
Yeah. And no one even knew his name. And the last story is On with the Dance, art by Russ Heath. Beautiful art here. Yeah, Heath is awesome. This has a conniving woman trying out for a dance part. And I mean, this lady is an awful woman. She let a former boyfriend go to jail, right?
She just seemed like she needed to meet the right man.
But I mean, they show the dude like shooting himself, like, and her being like, man, you know.
What's he complaining about? A hole in the head now?
If you like decompressed stories, these might not be for you.
Yeah.
So she threatens the woman who got the dance part at gunpoint to resign, but the woman's a witch and curses her to dance forever until she starves to death. And then even then her corpse dances on. It's pretty gross, but beautifully drawn by Heath.
I did wonder where all those dancing skeletons came from, Steve.
I love dancing skeletons.
So many skeletons.
Menace number 3 has another Bill Everett cover with a green werewolf on the who's what? Like wearing a wife beater, and I don't know.
Men in Black.
Well, that's the story that opens the issue with art by John Romita Sr.
Wow. Yeah, this was interesting. Whenever he shows up, I'm like, oh, let me check this out.
A bigoted guy, Jim Horton, Andrew, loses his job and forms this black hooded mob to dish out justice their style. Only the cops catch the group, but he escapes. And then he goes to take off his hood, and then there's another one underneath it, and no matter how many times he pulls it off, there's another hood underneath, and the police find him dead, having ripped off his own face.
Wow, that's very Baron Zemo of you.
I like this. I mean, it went on for a bit long, but I liked it. But it was funny. The hood looks more like a superhero hood. Yeah. It's got little pointy ear type things on it.
Definitely the vigilante, hooded vigilante look. The werewolf story, as on the cover, is drawn by Bill Everett, and it has this middle-aged woman taunting her husband about his crazy werewolf of obsession. So he finally's had enough, and he goes out to prove their existence. And he finds one that it's a false alarm, but then he gets bit, and he returns home, and his wife sees him transformed and shoots him in the back. But he's able to turn around and gouge her throat out. And then the police find them dead on top of each other. And, you know, after you die, when you're a werewolf, you turn back into the human. So they're just like, they're not surprised. They're like, this couple, they were always arguing. I'm not surprised it came to this. You know, they finally had enough of each other. I bet they were arguing over his crazy werewolf theories. Womp womp.
This was a kind of a strange one, I thought. I didn't necessarily get the, I guess that was the funny bit at the end, but it just seemed weird to me. Although I did like that the guy playing the prank on him gets a very elaborate werewolf.
Yeah. It's another opportunity for Everett to do a plastic fit, Alfred E. Newman-y guy looking fit, you know, different looking faces. Always good. The couple is not an attractive couple. The best art in this issue, though, is on this rodeo story by Russ Heath. Really drawn wonderfully. This rodeo clown resents the handsome cowboy rider star hero guy of the show. And the clown's job is to create a distraction when the rider gets thrown off the bull so that the rider can get to safety. This time he doesn't. But the bull hates the clown even more and just passes by the rider and gouges him to death instead.
I do always love the, well, if I murder the romantic rival, she'll love me even more. Logic
that, but it, I mean, it gives the opportunity for Russ Heath to draw Babe, though, right? I mean,
for sure, Babe the Blue Ox. That's because the bull is very blue colored.
And then the last story of the issue is drawn by Joe Manili. And that's you're gonna live forever.
You know, we've all read the Black Knight comic, but his work in these stories is really good. Yeah. Like, I haven't read a ton of them, except, like I said, I feel like that Black Knight comic, which is fine, but I've seen it a bunch. But this one, I'm like, boy, look at the detailed backgrounds and everything. And for a guy that's supposed to be fast, too, like, that's a lot. I like to be quick and detailed.
I felt the same way, that it's like, you know, you hear about Joe Manili over the years, that he was the guy who, you know, died too young. And he was like one of Stan's favorite go-to guys that he really thought was going to be something. And he was throwing a lot of work at him, and there was nothing he couldn't handle. And the work was so good and everything. And, you know, for us residing in the Marvel universe more and seeing reprints from that era, that's the book we keep seeing of Manili was that Black Knight book. But here we get treated to we get to see a little of what Stan saw. That was this guy was real good, and that's why I include him with these other guys. Definitely notable. A criminal gangster type is on the run, and he manages to come across this formula that allows him to live forever, but then he steps in quicksand and is swallowed up, so he's got to live forever, you know, submerged. So that sucks.
Yeah, I feel like we've really lost a lot of quicksand-based plots.
Yeah, yeah.
We're so popular in jungle comics and old cartoons and stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
The last time we had a quicksand-related issue, Steve.
Oh, I mean, I definitely spent some time as a kid, like, thinking about how I would get out of quicksand if I was in it, right?
Okay, like, don't struggle. Everyone knows you don't struggle, Steve.
Yep, you try to, like, lay out flat. Like, don't get yourself, you know, point toes down. Try to... Too funny.
Well, you never knew when you were going to run into it, because you have, like, at least once you're going to have to deal with quicksand.
Anyway, Menace number 4 had a really freaky cover. Another green, hairy monster by Bill Everett here on the cover of issue number 4. The first story is notable with Fred Kidda art. A vampire is born, and it goes through this history of this vampire that has his ups and downs and decides to branch out. And at the end, he becomes Stalin.
Oh, wait, I thought that was Eisenhower, Steve. I was like, what trenchant political commentary?
He had less hair. Eisenhower had less hair. The second story is Escape to the Moon with art by Russ Heath, where a Soviet agent in the USA fails in his mission and has both the commies and the FBI after him. But he learns about this test rocket that's going to the moon and back.
Uh-oh, and decides rocket.
He's going to stow away. It's the perfect thing to buy him some time. He goes through a lot of trouble to reach this rocket. And when he does, it's like Stonehenge in the Spinal Tap movie. It's like way too small for a passenger. He didn't realize it was like a bottle rocket.
Even if it had fit, I'm like, it's going to take a while to go and then come back. Unless he kills a scientist,
yeah,
they're going to know where it's coming back, right?
Yeah. So, and does he really have the training for this?
Yeah. Or, you know, all the food. You know,
or was he going to get out at the moon? I mean, this is before the moon landing, so they might have thought that he was just going to get out and, like, hide.
Live on green cheese on the moon. Yeah, exactly.
The next story is Genius, with art by Joe Manili, where this baby who is a super genius graduates college at 6 years old, kills it on Wall Street. Turns out he's also a telepath, so he can read minds to gain his advantage. And one fine day, he's contacted by a beauty from Saturn. That's like, finally, somebody on his level who has telepathic powers and everything, and they call him to them, and he builds a rocket and flies to Saturn or Venus or wherever the heck it was, but she's a cadaverous hag when he gets there. Wah, wah.
Man, I love Manili's evil baby and child.
Yeah, a lot of shadowing.
If they did like an Exorcist comic or whatever, he would have totally been the guy to do the evil young Damien.
Yeah, it's still obviously a kid, right? Like, these guys knew how to draw a kid. As opposed to an adult, with a, you know.
Wait a sec. I think I know who you're referring to.
Yeah, like every artist in the Bronze Age. The Madman has art by Bill Everett, and Bill's art is so good here. This one is a favorite story of mine. It's a precursor to a tale that I really dug from Tales to Astonish number 26 from 1961 that was reprinted for my young eyes in Chamber of Chills 19 from 1975 and was the cover feature of that. Actually got a Gil Kane cover on that Chamber of Chills issue. And you've got this new nurse hired to work at this remote asylum. And there's this creepy doctor showing her around and everything. And one of the patients there swears he saw 4 armed men under the earth. And everyone thinks he's crazy and he's there, but he swears it's true. And when no one's looking, the nurse comes back and confronts him and has him tell her story and tells her his story and everything. And she believes him. And the doctor shows up and is like, you know, I know something about you too. And she kills the doctor. And the guy's like, great, now we can, you know, he was the only thing preventing me from leaving here and helping to tell the surface world about these underground four-armed people that could invade us at any time. And then she kills him because she's got four arms. She's one of those people.
Yeah, I don't think even if she let him go, Steve, he was going to convince the world of the four. Yeah, the one thing I didn't like about this story, I know this was one of your favorite, is I wish they had framed her in the past to always be ambiguous about whether she could have had the two arms.
Right.
But he draws such a beautiful hourglass figure that you're like, there's nowhere she's hiding those two other arms. So
in Tales to Astonish 26, they fix this because in that it's a Kirby Ayers story, I think. And she's got a frumpier coat. She's got got like a house coat kind of a thing on.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was hoping for.
And it works out in a cool thing where the guy does a switcheroo on her, and she thinks that she thinks that the doctor's not on to her, but he is, and doesn't believe her, and he goes to incarcerate the guy, but he's really taking him out of the room and then locking the door on her. And she starts banging on the door like, let me out of here, let me out of here. And the more she bangs, the more arms start banging. And you realize that she's one of them and she's just banging on but she's trapped. So the doctor doesn't die and he wins in the end. But kind of a cool take on it.
I want it clear, though, I do enjoy the classic hourglass figure of these femme fatale. I don't want that to be the message to take away from this.
Bill Everett does draw some nice babes.
For this story, that ambiguity would have been more my speed.
Issue 5 of Menace is a important one to the Marvel's history, especially in the Bronze Age, with a really fun zombie cover by Bill Everett. And that's the first story is Zombie, where a zombie who's wandering the Louisiana swamp has his master call him and is sent into town to steal some money for him. But things go sideways and he comes back empty handed. So then he sends the zombie to attack this girl in the main house so he can rescue her and gain her affection. But when the zombie sees her, he recollects that it's his own daughter and then strangles his master instead and then finds his own grave and like lays down. And it's a simple little story, but this was the zombie that was later named Simon Garth. He was the basis for the 70s Tales of the Zombie magazine. And the first issue of that, the story ends immediately before this story begins. It ends right with him wandering the swamp. So you get his story up to right when this one starts, which is just fun continuity.
I got to know if Andrew speculated on this one.
As a man who grew up, I would have totally bought any of these, but they were very expensive when I took a cursory look. I would love to have any of these. I mean, just reader copies, but they're beyond the price I would pay. But as a moron who grew up in like an age of zombie cinema, you know, all the Romero movies and all that stuff, I love this zombie design.
Yeah.
Like Everett really, I can see why this stuck in people's heads and people were like, yeah, this is a zombie that just looks super distinctive. Not that the shambling corpse zombie doesn't look good, but this one it conveys that, but it's also very unique. I'm like, that's a great design. Plus, love the woman in pink with the giant rabbit head at the costume party.
But you know where this kind of mindset, this design lives on is Solomon Grundy, right? I mean, he's that same kind of, he's that same type of zombie for sure. He's one of these zombies, a chombi, right? More of a Louisiana zombie. The next story, Crackdown, has Joe Manili art with this ganglord warning this small-time crook to lay low, not do any muggings for like a week or so because the senator's coming to town and guy can't help it. He's got to just do one mugging. And of course, it turns out to be the senator. Wah, wah.
Well, you don't want your first name to be Mouse, Steve. I thought that was good. A nickname till he was testifying in Congress. Yeah,
you know where you are on the hierarchy if your name is Mouse. Your
maybe is his Mouse. Parents weren't. Should have thought bigger for him, but I do love the stereotypical looking at his nails like he's buffing them up right before the hammer drop. Yeah, just the caricatures. Yeah, again, this Manili guy, really good stuff. If I mean, not that Black Knight isn't bad, but to reiterate, check this stuff out. Super fun, great artist with a real sense of humor and action and all that stuff. I can see how he could have been a real fun guy to do all sorts of different stories with.
Nightmare has George Tuska art, and this is a weird one where a guy is terrorized in his dreams by a guy he killed, and he tells a bartender and takes the bartender advice, but it just gets worse, and when he comes to tell the bartender about it and confronts him, the bartender's the devil.
Yeah.
But a good George Tuska devil. A devilishy. Then the rocket ship has Russ Heath art, and we have another date in the far future here. In 2005, a rocket carries humans to Venus to settle and relieve our planet of overpopulation. But they did not do their homework because the vapors of Venus are acidic, and as soon as they get there, everyone just melts when they arrive and dies.
I do some sci-fi underpopulation stories too.
I loved I always had a soft spot for like 40s and 50s sci-fi because it has all this kind of nonsense space-taking philosophical discussions that the has in the middle about you know what the right way to solve, and I just has this, even when they're dark, it has like a weird optimism, I feel like.
Yeah.
I think it'd be sad if they saw it out in the future.
And I love Heath's, rendering of like, you know, the, scientists and the hero types and the family and everything. He's just great. Great with faces.
They always keep that cute girlfriend in every panel for mysterious story reasons, I'm sure.
Keeps me interested. Menace number 6 has a Greymoor ghost cover by Bill Everett, where a ghost is coming out of a cauldron or a well and pulling this guy in. No!
And wait, I thought he was trying to pull his pants down, Steve. Pants him in front of his friends.
His purple pants. Maybe it's Bruce Banner.
Oh, kind of looks like him.
That's the opening story, The Greymoor Ghost, with art by Bill Everett, where this shady old antique dealer comes across a bargain where he can resell a castle full of antiques that he's buys for $1, but the antiques are cursed.
Why is that guy dressed like the Penguin?
He can never leave the castle, and he becomes the new caretaker ghost after having a heart attack when he meets the previous ghost tenant.
I do. My favorite part is how over the top. When they have a whole segment where he rips off some little kid.
It's
almost awesome. Like a comical, like Uncle Scrooge manner. Where
for real.
Goes down out the back. And
runs to the Five and Dime down the street and buys a cheap thing and resells it. Yeah. Again, Everett's good. I mean, he could draw a fat man running so fast that neither of his feet are touching the ground.
So, yeah, just an important allegory for comic book collecting, I feel, Steve.
Checkmate is drawn and inked by Gene Colan, where a chess grandmaster kills his wife and then goes underground, changes his appearance, and he can't help but get back into the game, though, and a mafia don tells him he has to win a chess match or else. But his opponent is the second best chess player in the world, who totally knows him and would know his moves and everything. So if he wins, he's busted because he's the only person who could beat this guy. And if he loses, the mob gets him. So instead, he takes his gun and he shoots himself in the head.
Checkmate.
You can't do that after the code. Bang.
Yeah, that one. The part I liked is when he meets his
bride to be, and she's a little girl, and he's like already a chess guy. I'm like, oh yeah, making this guy kind of creepy.
The corpse is written by Stan, but drawn by Russ Heath, where a guy's wife has a heart attack and dies in their bedroom. And then he's like shown frantically trying to keep like his neighbors and people coming for her. And it all seems like it's happening all like that night. But I think it's over a long period of time because when they do show up, she's like a rotted corpse and just a skeleton left. And he was a ghost there all along.
it's so weird story. I'm like, what is this going to be? One of those things where like, they're going to think I did it. And I'm like, oh, yep. I think I know where this is going. I gotta get rid of the body.
I like it. It's so bad that the police detective is like holding his nose when he. Yeah. But this was one of my favorite twists because the twist is they were actually in love and it was a happy marriage, which is never in these stories. So.
Happy when one of them's a ghost. And the last story this issue is drawn by John Romita Sr., Flying Saucer, where these Martian saucers invade but lie dormant. So the scientists explore inside, and then the doors close, and all their knowledge is sucked out of them, and then the invasion begins in earnest. The saucers were the Martians.
It was a different time, Steve. Now they would just send peons into the saucers, but back then the real important people would do the hands-on work.
This is another one that was redone in the early Journey into Mystery or Tales to Astonish era with Ditko doing the art. We're a little bit different, switched around, but basically the same idea. Menace number 7 has a cover attributed to Saul Brodsky. We know from the Bronze Age more as like a production, like administration type guy. But the first story
is Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's what I was going to. I was trying to figure out how to frame it, but it's like a crude Blade Runner type story where.
Yeah, it's great. They're hunting down robots who are posing as people. And what does it mean to be human? Philip K. Dick would approve. Assuming he doesn't mind it sort of bluntly washed over in 8 pages.
They're looking for the last one. And the chief hunter guy ends up being the last robot. Like, even he didn't know.
Yeah, but I think most of us knew by about 3 pages.
That made me think of Blade Runner, too, because it was all the thing of, like, was he a replicant and all that? And crazy.
Then the next story is the Exxon Valdez, Steve. So
Planet of Living Death, with art by Russ Heath, where the drunk commander of a spacecraft, he's a crew member. He's always screwing things up, and he's, like, harassing the captain's daughter and stuff. And they crash land on this hostile alien planet. And he cooperates, screwing over his teammates, asking for a ship and the captain's daughter as payment. And they pay up, the aliens, but they send their captain's daughter instead with him. And she's ugly.
Man, is that like a freaked out face?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy the coloring goof? Where in one page all the crew people are shirtless, and then they remember to put their shirts on.
I almost saved that panel to post on one of my like weird comic panels pages on Facebook, because that's a weird one. And the dialogue in that panel is weird, too. It's just a weird panel.
Yeah, it was like, ooh, a ship of manly men who work without their shirts on.
Crazy. The Witch in the Woods is drawn by Joe Sinnott and has a dad admonishing his kid for reading horror comics, and it reads him Hansel and Gretel instead and ends up being totally horrified. This one has great Joe Sinnott art. And even if it didn't say it was Joe Sinnott, I could tell just by the ears. Joe Sinnott just does the perfect ears.
So you great art.
Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
You weren't going to mention the tech stories, but you probably weren't going to mention the polio precautions in here as well.
Aren't those weird? It's like COVID stuff.
I know.
But it has the weird, this is in the 50s, I guess, so I don't think
family
we've had the benefit of really having all like the horrible Nazi torture scientist data and all that stuff, because they're still making the mistakes of associating being cold with having a fever and, like, you know,
being tired.
Yeah. Like, there's like, don't be cold. Don't have shivers. And it's like, well, that's not the same thing as having a fever. Like, you can't get cold. You can't get a cold by being cold, you know? And believe me, the Nazis tried to make people get colds by getting them cold and dunking them in freezing water and all these horrible, torturous things. But at least we learned some stuff out of it in the long run. But
I like the Joe Sinnott art, but I felt this is one of those, like, the writer has run out of story idea sort of things that is always somewhat annoying when you're like, okay, man, maybe Stan, I know you don't want to part with a single paycheck, but maybe bring somebody on to pitch a few fresh ideas.
But we're also pretty jaded now in the fairy tales were actually pretty graphic mindset, you know, lens. Like, back then, that was probably pretty clever to be like, hey, yeah, if you think about it, Hansel and Gretel is actually pretty gory. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't know how easy it was for people to see through the veneer of the children's rhyme or children's song or children's fable aspect of some of the really grotesque stuff that was happening in some of those old tales.
Yeah, I don't know when the, for lack of a better term, whitewashing of that stuff happened. Obviously, Disney has something to do with it, but I remember even as a kid hearing about, you know, she dances in the shoes until she's dead, and, you know, the Brothers Grimm stuff was around when I was a kid. I don't know how prevalent when that renaissance of material came. I maintain it still stand being a little lazy.
Yeah, agreed. And the last is Your Name is Frankenstein, which is also kind of a lazy written story, because it's a Frankenstein story where just Frankenstein can't catch a break, you know.
Yeah, we're the real monsters ever. But that sad sack Frankenstein does, it's great. Like, I felt bad for him before anything bad happened to him.
Issue 8 starts with the Lizard Men, also drawn by Joe Manili, where this giant lizard man represents a subterranean race of lizard men that just want a little portion of land above ground that they can go and enjoy the sun, you know. But the humans at the UN won't budge, and war ends up being declared, and the lizard man returns to his people, and they wipe out humanity by turning on all the volcanoes.
Maybe he ate too many kids. I don't know. Or his own kids. But they could have set this whole thing up. Like, okay, you can vacation over here and then charge them lots of money.
Right.
And set up all his facilities. Like, it would have been a good money-making venture, I think.
Your money's good here.
Yeah, they could probably bring up all kinds of gold and jewels and stuff from the center of the earth.
This is true.
The next story is John Romita Sr. drawn, The Werewolf Was Afraid, where this great English hunter won't kill prey unless they attack him first, and he wants to hunt the werewolf, but the werewolf's like reading a paper and totally just chilling in the park, and he can't get the werewolf to attack him, and he's trying to agitate him, and he's getting all frustrated and everything, and when he finally gets mad, so mad that he puts down his gun, the werewolf attacks him, and basically he was doing the same thing to him, saying that he prefers his English men with their blood boiling in anger before he eats them.
I know, he almost looks like the jackal or like the predator in panels.
I thought the opening one reminded me of kind of a little bit of Man Bat.
Yeah,
because he's kind of sad and like the little sad faced, and I'm like, oh great, now I'm feeling bad for the werewolf too.
The fourth story of The Face of Horror is written, drawn by Russ Heath, with an ugly guy accidentally killing the one plastic surgeon who was skilled enough to fix his face in the first place.
I did not like this story
Lemire drawing
at all, because that's exactly what I look like, Steve. So I don't reading this thing.
Heath did the next story too, Three Dimensions, with a hypnotist planning the perfect crime where his henchmen and he will show a film of him hypnotizing and play it for an audience in a theater, and the whole audience will be hypnotized, and then they'll rob them, but the hypnotist and his cronies get hypnotized too, so much that they don't even remember why they're there.
Now, tell me this wasn't product placement for all those ads to buy hypnotism kits in the back of the couch.
The last story, it had pencils by L. Ada, and it's just mentionable because it's like this weird wooden woman Pinocchio thing. Like, imagine Pinocchio with boobs. It's really weird.
I thought it looked great, though. Like, the sculptor guy is very almost feral. Like, they pronounce the canines overly so to make him look... It's done in everything's kind of caricatured, except for the regular people. But there's a witch and him, and everything looks kind of over the top in a fun way. I mean, it's one of those stories we've all heard before, but I did thought it looked cool.
The ninth issue, now that we're into it, and it's after its hiatus, comes back with not the same strategy of having that same group of artists doing everything. I get a little more variety here, and they add some reprints from some like Mystic issues and things. But the cover on Menace number 9 is by Gene Colan.
Yeah, this is probably my favorite cover out of all of them.
Good. By the way. It's a good one.
I really liked it. The black and the little like zombie guy. And I don't know, for some reason, this one was like, whoa.
I like the colors too.
Pulled up like the actual, what the print looked like to see. Yeah, again, there's no way I can buy one of these, but I'm like, boy, this would be fun.
Especially with the black cover, like that's got to be hard to get in good shape like that. I also laugh that it's coming back after a while, so it's got to be all new ideas. And I'm like, oh yeah, The Walking Dead. How about that?
My favorite story in this issue that I thought was the most notable was the Fangs of the Wolf with the Bill Everett art. And it's just one of those classic, oh no, the werewolf is revealed to be him type of stories.
Well, the mistake
was the robot.
Was after the layoff, they should have started renumbering and had all new Menace number 1.
All new Menace.
Menace number 10 has a Russ Heath cover that is only notable because it's Russ Heath, but wasn't not the most dynamic. But the story in here that really jumped out at me was the last one with the Joe Sinnott art in the cardboard box, where we're wondering who keeps chopping off people's heads and collecting them like trophies. Doesn't seem like it could be the mute, wheelchair-bound, crippled guy, right? But wrong, it was a disguise all along.
I was like Professor Xavier.
I will say in 9, I love any time they make the critic a bad guy, too, because they love that. Like, critics are just rich vampires on society.
Oh yeah. For sure. All right, anything else on 10?
I mean, the fake was a good idea, but I thought it went on a bit too much.
Yep. Again with the L. Ida art. I had to look him up, and he did quite a bit of art during that time period, but I really wasn't familiar with his stuff. Menace 11 is the final issue in January 1954, most notable for the first 5-page story drawn by John Romita, Robot.
Oh, this is my favorite story. I forgot this was in here.
And this is
so Agents of Atlas territory. It's
exactly.
M11.
It's the first appearance of M11, the human robot from Agents of Atlas, and that's why he was given that name, Kevin, is because he first appeared in Menace 11. M11.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, going through here, I'm like, oh yeah.
Agents,
yeah, this is so great.
Agents of Atlas number 6 from 2007, they retold this origin story and slightly retconned it to include the Yellow Claw.
Yeah.
I do enjoy how Isaac Asimov about 10 years earlier had released the iRobot stories.
Sure.
So even in the lettering, they like slide the in at the top of it. Like, if we can just get 10% of the kids a little confused.
It's a fun little story, though. This brilliant scientist creates a robot that responds to voice commands, like remotely. And his business partner wants to sell now and sell high, right? But the scientist insists that it's still not right, and he's got further adjustments to make. Because he gives it a command, and it just repeats doing it nonstop.
So I love that. As a guy that took very simple computer programming back in the day, like, this tracks totally the businessman that wants to sell it before it works, and the computer programmer who can't get the basic bugs out.
So but he has the solution.
He does. He comes up with this regulator device that's going to fix the problem. But before he can install it, his partner has already stolen the voice remote command device and orders it to kill the man in the room when the scientist goes in to install the regulator. So it never gets attached. And when the partner guy goes in to retrieve the robot to go sell it, it kills him too, because then he's the man in the room. And then the doors open and just goes wanders out in the world looking for men in rooms to kill.
That is nuts. Totally thinking of Futurama and Bender going, hey, do you want to kill all humans?
Yep, and Stan's talking to you, the reader, like, you know, hey, you know.
Yeah.
You might know, and actually it's uncredited as to who the writer is, but the style of it, wouldn't be surprised if it was Stan.
Yeah, if you ever hear a knock on the door late at night, it could be M11 coming to kill you.
That's why I never stay in a room, guys. I always stay outside. That's right. Or in a hallway, or a vestibule.
So again,
test his programming.
The little halfway point to why he was in Agents of Atlas was because of that what if story, right? Where Roy Thomas pulls him from this era for the Atlas era Avengers, a what if story. And then that becomes the basis for Agents of Atlas. But there was a nice, fun, circular place to come back to. And all of a sudden, there he is.
Yeah, nice feeling of dread at the end of this one, where you're just like,
and then you end up liking him so much in Agents of Atlas.
It's true.
Or do you?
Wait, we didn't like him after this story? I thought it was kind of cool. I mean, I can totally get it. He had a job to do, and he was doing it.
One other story was notable to me in this, Locked In, the last story, because it has art by Bob Powell, who is another favorite Golden Age artist of mine, because he's from he painted some of the Mars Attacks cards and did the art on the Batman trading card set in the 60s.
You must read his Frankenstein stories, though.
A woman does the dirty work to track down her husband, who split with Cash after they committed a murder robbery together. She finds him, kills him, but the ghosts of their murder victims keep her trapped there in this yucky place that she despises.
I want to live in that world, Steve, where there are just endless amounts of rich hermits that retire from society. Yep.
Hey, like, there were places you could go and get lost, you know?
I thought the one, I mean, the story didn't do anything, but the Jack Katz, the My Other Body, thought, again, I love the all the different faces and character, like, really strong, and like, I know it's silly with like a yellow shirt and orange pants or whatever, but it really stood out. I don't know, I just thought visually that was one I liked, but the femme fatale angle and all that doesn't do it, but just from a visual.
The end of this issue hypes the content of the next issue, but the issue was canceled, and the material for issue 12 gets used for Astonishing 35 later that year in October of 54. So I mean, looking back, I like the execution of the experiment of trying to use this tight bunch of artists and have them come back and back and do stories each issue. I think the first 8 issues are really tight, and I thought the storytelling was really fun. Yeah, there was a couple of mail-in stories in there or whatever, but the art kept up its end of the bargain all along. And then I think after the hiatus, things were a little less organized and had less of a unified vision or whatever you might call it. But cool series. I'm glad we went back to check it out because there's some real nice gems in here.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff in that Atlas era. Probably want to check out some Venus stuff later, too.
Oh, I would love to. I again, more Bill Everett work on that book.
Always like, I like to think about if I was a kid in 1953 or whatever, how fun it must have been, like down to the newsstand and just seeing hundreds of comics all lined up and got a few dimes in my pocket, burning a hole in my pocket to grab some funky comic books.
Just thinking of that era of being a kid, even in our time, we didn't have until, at least me, until I was a teenager, having like VCRs and that kind of a thing to be able to like watch something over again. Like we didn't have that option. TV came and went, and if your mother walked in front of the TV, you missed it. That was it. It was gone. And the only way that you could relive media was by rereading it or rereading the comic book adaptation of the movie or the photo book, souvenir type book of the movie if you had that or that kind of a thing. And comic books were a thing where you could check it out and tell your friend about it and have him look at it and look at it together and look at it again and pass them around. And it was a great medium for a time where we couldn't repeat and re-experience stuff over and over again except this way.
Oh, you forgot the best one, the Viewmaster.
Dude,
the little click.
every state park we went to, I got a Viewmaster reel from. For sure.
I loved like all the superhero stuff. I was such a fiend for that crap when I was a kid. I would
Scooby-Doo
spin those reels endlessly. The little cheap 3D effect and everything. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen this. The superhero stuff. Everything I ever saw in Viewmaster wasn't that.
Oh man, that's all I. As a kid, I was crazy for superheroes, like a little dummy.
And the animation things they used from it would be like the Superman stuff would be from the old Filmation Superman. You know, some cool stuff. Really
and
cool
the,
stuff.
The, yeah, and it always looked that 3D thing with the two eyes really made it capture your imagination in a way. Like you said, because you weren't, you know, if it wasn't Saturday morning or whenever the hell the cartoon was on, like this was kind of it to experience that stuff.
And then that Virtual Boy came out from Nintendo and people are like, yeah, it's the Viewmaster all over again. And then you're like, my eyes.
they're falling out.
I even had the slide projector for Star Wars.
Oh, cool.
That was not the fidelity was terrible. Like it wasn't like a Viewmaster or anything, but it was just training the youth of tomorrow for business meetings and PowerPoint presentations. But it was really cool for a kid, you know.
All right, let's hit one more quick one before we end the episode. So that we're not just way, way, way in the Atlas era. We got to hit something.
New comic, brand new comics.
How about Bronze Age?
That's brand new.
Will that do? We've got Giant Size Creatures number one featuring the Werewolf by Night, which is also on the Marvel Unlimited, and it'll be part of the Giant Size Marvel Omnibus that'll be out later this year or early next year. And this one is from April 1974.
I was so enamored, I ordered a print copy, which they said would be here in time, and it's not. They get those updates, and you're like, oh, I normally don't leave bad feedback, but you shouldn't just don't advertise. If you can't deliver it, just don't put in a date. Like, it was just a reader copy, and I bought that one because they were like, oh, it'll get there in time. So, word to the wise, just don't put a time in. Like, then I wouldn't be irritated. But, oh, can't wait to get my filthy little hands on it and flip those pages. Because I got mad when the one on the Unlimited seemed to, there's an article by Tony Isabella and all this other stuff they just omitted from the dumb Marvel online. I don't know if that was
And the reprints.
Lawsuits or whatever, but I was like, oh, fine. I'll just go get my own copy. They got reader copies. I mean, because it's some fake first appearance, it's slightly elevated for a reader copy, but you know me, kids, I don't really care.
So this is a follow-up to the Claws of the Cat series that was canceled, where Greer Nelson, the cat, tries to rescue her benefactor who's being kidnapped by Hydra, but is shot in the back. And when she wakes, she learns that her mentor is spirited away, her away to this lair of secret cat people. And she's one of them. And Greer was shot with a radioactive ray, it turns out. And she's going to die of radiation poisoning unless she undergoes this mystical, chemical, and mental process to become one of them. So Tigra, the werewoman, is born. It's Tigra's first appearance.
So weird.
But is it really, Steve? The lady was already around before. Ugh. This is that Lucius Fox's daughter problem all over again. But I do think it's funny. Like, you go to work for Hydra. We're going to give you a gun. What, one that kills people? No, one that gives them radiation poisoning.
Well, it did knock her out first. It did take her out. So it would incapacitate you and then kill you.
Instead of one of those ones that shoots, I don't know, bullets or something.
I also like when they're on the when they're like manhandling her, the agents, the she's pretending that she doesn't know that they're Hydra agents or whatever, and that she doesn't know what's going on, and they refer to their uniforms as sacred garb. I was like, ooh, the Hydra uniforms are sacred garb. And that the one guy clubs her in the head with a gun and is like, "Hail Hydra, baby." And the other guy corrects him. It's like, "Hey, have a care, Agent B4. None may use our oath with so little respect." So like saying "Hail Hydra, baby" is like a little too much lingo attached to it. Like, you gotta, it reinforces the idea of what they're doing as being like a real cult sacred thing.
What I like about that story, Steve, is every one of us is one of those two guys at work. You know what I mean? Either you're the work guy that takes that stuff way too seriously, or you're the work guy that doesn't take it seriously enough. So figure out if you're the Hail Hydra baby or the, hey, cut it out, B4. We have a sacred duty.
Yeah. Oh, I should have mentioned, too, that the story is written by Tony Isabella with art by Don Perlin and, unfortunately, inks by Vinny Coletta. So we get the impossibly asymmetrical eyes that just drive me nuts at times. Come on.
Yeah, I generally liked it a lot, except some of the crazy limbs and stuff, too, on Tigra. I mean, I bust Rob Liefeld for it, so I got to stay consistent.
So Tigra is born here in the cat people's lair, and the cat people enclave is attacked, and they're all taken prisoner by Hydra, except Greer is able to escape, and now she's got to rescue her mentor. And
did you love the and the flashback story, the cat people pilgrims wearing the big pilgrim hats?
I also thought it was weird when they're abducting the older lady, the benefactor lady, they have one of the Hydra agents have a thought balloon where he says, "God, I feel Hydra's ranks are being refilled solely from the baser classes." And it's like, why are they even bothering to have a Hydra agent thinking anything about the state of the recent recruits of Hydra? It had nothing to do with the story or anything. It was a really weird insight to have portrayed. Like,
like the writers inserting themselves into the story.
No, I think,
like,
again, guys,
I don't know. Really
think
strange.
About your job. You're either that guy or the guy he's complaining about.
Yeah. And then I'm
spoiler, I'm the guy he's complaining about.
But wait, wasn't this supposed to be a Werewolf by Night features? So Jack Russell's walking along a remote Mexican beach, right?
I cannot take that name seriously, Steve. We've got to call him something else. How about
Jack?
Russell or something.
Just Jack. And he encounters Tigra fighting off Hydra agents. And she does fight them off. And then she and the werewolf go a few rounds before more Hydra agents arrive and take them both out. But they leave Jack because they're only, you know, they're not after him. They're after her. And when the werewolf awakes, he wants to find Tigra, and like he might even love her. And he tracks her scent to the hidden Hydra lair and kills the main Hydra leader guy and that smug agent B4 guy. And rescues Tigra, and then they in turn rescue the old maid lady, who proceeds to release the Black Plague on the rest of the Hydra squad. It's pretty brutal.
Ow. Yeah.
I like how she tries to be like, oh, don't kill all these Hydra guys. And I'm like, hey, go ahead and kill them. Everyone you kill, two more will replace them. So
exactly.
I mean, they'll be from the baser class, but hey, times are tough all over, you know?
And in the story, Greer Nelson starts out being able to change from being human into Tigra and back with her cat people ring or whatever, like thing ring, do your thing. but by the end of the issue, by the end of the issue, she can't do it anymore. It's like, oh, you can never do it again. So now you're trapped as Tigra. And then giant-sized creatures would go on four more issues, but as giant-sized werewolf by night, picking up the numbering from this issue. What else? Yeah. You didn't get the issue to see what else was in the issue, but I can tell you, other besides the text piece, there was a few reprints.
Yeah, and some, I guess, like pencil design sketch by Gil Kane and stuff. Yeah, I'm all excited to see all this. All this goodness that's in print. I mean, I don't care that it's a reader copy. I also wanted to see what it looked like in print. If I can always, when it's a story that interests me or is fun, man, I'm a sucker for print. I mean, I end up giving this stuff away eventually. But still, it's fun to look at it when you can. I mean, I'm sure I could pull up Where Walks the Werewolf from one of the other because it was, you know, Creatures on the Loose. So I could probably read that. But, you know, you want it all in one package. I don't know why they don't do this. It's not like they're paying Reed Crandall royalties or anything.
All right. Any last words, Kevin?
Ow!
Well said. All right, thanks, guys. Enjoy the Halloween season. Look for that Halloween indie noise, too. And until Tigra gets treated for cat scratch fever, make mine Marvel. Later.